Today I'm going to be talking about methods that I and my advisor, Mike Klesch, have been doing to effectively label surfaces using a novel construct that we call a text scaffold. So I'm going to actually start from the end and show you what we want to do, which is to take a complicated surface such as this brain model and put labels directly onto it. And we think that this is actually something that would aid interactive exploration, where you can rotate them all around and have the label effectively stay as close as possible to the labeled region. But how do we do that? Well, if we do something naive, like try to stick the text directly onto this surface, and in a way the surface is about as worst case as possible, but in any case the text gets warped and by the curvature of the surface, and it ends up being hidden by the folds themselves. So this is clearly not the right way to go. What we've come up with is what we call a text scaffold, which bounds the surface. It's not necessarily convex everywhere. It follows the general contours of the surface, and we place the text directly onto that. And this is what we call a text scaffold. And so we start with the idea of cartography as sort of our guiding principles. And we know that cartographers have been labeling 2D maps and globes, which are essentially a two-dimensional problem, for thousands of years, and they're getting pretty good at it. Here's, you know, Google Maps, and it's pretty good. And there are a number of different basic principles, and we distill some of what we think are the four main principles for labeling a street map like this one, where, first of all, and primarily, the text should be legible. It should follow a smooth, probably straight path, and you can see that on the roads. The text should be visible. It should always be on top of other features. It may track important features. It doesn't necessarily have to, but in the case of, you know, curvy roads like at the very top you can see there, it's nice to have the text follow those features, roads and rivers, and it should be close to a labeled feature. So these are all pretty obvious, but what do we do in 3D? Well, the same principles apply. And we formulated four goals, which are more or less analogous to the previous ones that we believe will help us formulate what we think is a good text scaffold and the properties for that. So again, legibility is key. We have a surface here where the text is not legible and it's clearly not effective labeling. So the surface must be smooth. This is one of the primary examples where a highly curved surface causes text warping. It's just not easy to parameterize it, and so it's not easy to put a label. Secondly, the text should be visible, right? The scaffold can't enter occluded regions or you can't read it. And the scaffold must bound the object, or you see in the bottom, the text ends up intersecting with the surface. So those are not good cases. The surface must be proximal. We believe that as much as is possible, the label should lie as close to the corresponding region as we can. And finally, we believe that the text itself should convey the shape. This is a kind of corollary to proximity. So that's an introduction to what we use to formulate this, and I'm now going to talk about how we generate the text scaffolds. So as an overview of our process, we generally start by taking three different types of input. One, it could be a mesh, could be constructive solid geometry, it could be a scalar field, but all of these are converted into a distance transform. We then dilate and add visibility weight in order to remove the scaffold from any pocket, and then smooth the field in order to make sure that it's as smooth as possible, erode it back in order to ensure proximity, and then build a scaffold mesh from that field. So why a distance field? Well, there's a number of nice properties for distance fields that you probably already know. Besides being compatible with any input source, they allow arbitrary topological changes, which is nice in the sense that we want to sometimes put text over regions that have handles or very severe crevices, things like that. And they're actually quite simple to work with. So our first step is to rasterize it into voxels from a mesh or constructive solid geometry source. In the scalar field, we generally just resample the field. And in all the figures in the remaining sets of this in this slide, we actually only really need a 40 cubed voxel grid. We build a field using a vector city vector distance transform, which is nice because in dilation, we actually find ourselves quite a bit far away from the original surface. And this particular transform is actually very accurate compared to other simpler transforms further from the surface. Finally, each voxel contains the scalar distance to the surface, and we use a convention of negative values being inside and positive outside. So we have this concept of visibility weight, which is something that we use in order to fill in deep pockets. And because dilation generally just causes the surface to come out by a particular value, it doesn't necessarily fill in pockets in the way that we'd like to. So we have this idea of visibility weight, which is simply for a given voxel, we sample, this is 2D, so there's 8 directions. In 3D, there would be 26 directions. We sample the visibility across all of the different directions and come up with a scalar value, which is essentially how visible or occluded is this particular voxel. This is then subtracted from the original field, which gets us a new field, which causes the pocket to bump outward. And combining this with dilation, here is our formula. It's actually quite simple. We have a visibility threshold, which in general we set to be about 0.5, which makes sure that regions that are less than half occluded don't change whatsoever. So this only causes interior regions to pop outward. The ambient value is then taken to be that value, normalized, and then weighted against a W sub A parameter, which lets you scale how much you really want this value to influence the final scaffold. W sub D is a constant dilation amount if you wish to do that as well. And this is just sort of an illustration of what happens as you scale W sub A. The orange interior scaffold, these are sets of scaffolds that are all sort of overlaid on top of one another. The orange interior scaffold has no ambient weight whatsoever, and then increasing to higher and higher weights in the yellow. So this illustrates, as you can see in this pocket, that that by increasing the ambient weight, it doesn't really change those surfaces surrounding the model, but only really has a high effect inside of that pocket. Our next step is to convolve the field with a Gaussian filter, which effectively smooths it. In two dimensions, this is pretty simple. You just convolve it with a Gaussian and then come up with another isosurface, which is derived from that. And as you can see, that new isosurface is smoother. By choosing larger Gaussians, you get a smoother isosurface. And our final step is to erode this. So by dilating and smoothing, the isosurface has moved outward from the model. So what we do is we just search for a value that will let the isosurface contract back in so it continues to bound but is now as tight as possible with the original model. And then we erode using that value. So now that we have a scaffold, all we need to do is extract a mesh from it, because we're going to use this mesh in order to lay text. And we use Martian cubes. It's simple, it's fast. And unfortunately, it has some minor sampling artifacts, the stair-stepping artifacts that you can see there, which are mitigated somewhat by the subpixel precision that we use in our distance transform. But in this case, we just perform a small pass of Taubman smoothing. This, I should point out on the left, is a pathological case. It's a very, very small grid with no smoothing applied. So in general, our original surface coming directly out of the margin cubes method is much better, but doesn't illustrate the point. So now that we have a text scaffold, we'd like to label it. In this paper, we describe three different classes of cartographic labels. These are sort of the classic ones that cartographers use, and they follow a point label, lineal label, and aerial label, which I'll describe next. So a point label, here's Wisconsin, where I'm from, and a point label is any label that's applied to a particular point in the map. And one of the difficulties with a point label is in what direction do you apply it. On a 2D map, it's usually relatively easy because the standard way to do it is just to make it horizontal, in the sense that, well, any other direction is as good, but horizontal is more readable. In the 3D case, this is a little bit harder, since we don't have any notion of horizontal as the viewpoint changes. And indeed, we're generally constructing all of these labels in model space, so we're viewpoint agnostic. So what we've decided to do is instead find the axis of least curvature by just doing a simple operator on that point and move points outward by a distance proportional to the length of the label that we want to use. Project them onto the surface and smooth the path in order to get a nice straight path. And I'll talk about path smoothing in a moment, but here's our final result for point labeling. Another class is lineal labeling, where we'd like a feature that's described by a line. And in general, what cartographers do is, if possible, sometimes it's not necessarily possible, but if possible, they'd like to label it using the path itself, so the label tracks along that feature. In our case, we have two different kinds of lineal label. One, a user can just simply sketch a path. So by sweeping the mouse across the surface, we basically find all the vertices that that mouse comes in proximity to. This is then smoothed again, and text applied on top of that path. A separate kind of labeling that we implemented was a geodesic path labeling. So this is described by two points, a start and an end. In this case, we find a geodesic path that cuts as straight as possible through these through the triangles, and then apply the text onto that. Finally, we have aerial labels. So these are defined by a region or an area. And in this case, what cartographers often do is apply the label along the sort of long axis of that area. You can see that if in this case with Wisconsin, often states like California are labeled using a California that tracks along that region. So this is generally what we do too. Here you're looking actually at the text scaffold itself. You can imagine there's a region underneath this which is then projected onto the scaffold and then parameterized. So now we have a two-dimensional texture which we can then apply a medial axis transform to in order to come up with the longest path inside of that. So that medial axis transform defines a sort of nice path which stays away from the edges. We then apply the text to that path. This can be smooth if necessary in order to make that text straighter, but this is the final result. So I've mentioned path smoothing in a couple of different cases, and it in fact is common among all of our different labeling schemes. And first, what we want to do is we want to take a sequence of points as input, and they're not necessarily on the scaffold surface, but in most cases they'll generally be on the scaffold surface to start. We'll interpolate it and then fix the endpoints. This is then averaged, so each of these points are averaged using a weighted average of their nearest neighbors in order to come up with a smoother version of the original set of points. And then they're projected back onto the surface. Since they left this surface, we then project them back on and iterate. And what this generally does is, in two dimensions, it just distributes them more evenly. You'll find that the points will start to get about the same distance from one another. In 3D, it causes a highly curved path in the path space to become straighter. And the number of iterations will generally provide a balance between what the user originally stroked, which can often be very, ugly, curvy, and a straighter path, which is often desirable. So we can go kind of back and forth to see the difference between the two. In three dimensions, again, this is our set of points that a user stroked, and clearly we don't want to put text on these points. But by a small amount of path smoothing, we can recover the original user's intention of these points and project a label onto that. So a couple of notes about how we render text. We use a very new technique called alpha-tested magnification to render our letters, which is actually very nice because it allows us to draw our large letters that you see there with a small 128 by 128 texture that we sample from with very little visible aliasing. We can zoom all the way in as close as we want to. And as a side benefit, by using our shader, we can add outline and glow effects that you might have noticed here. Here we've added an outline and a nice white glow around these letters by just simply modifying the shader. And this helps set the text off against the background. Letters themselves are each given their own local parameterization. So basically what we do is we walk across the path and give, for each point on the path, we give a quick local parameterization. There are a lot of different ways to parameterize, but since our letters are very small and local, we use the exponential map method, which is very, very fast and reasonably accurate locally. letter orientation themselves are computed within this parameter space and are weighted along the baseline. So we, in fact, somewhat smooth the orientations of the letters too, so that they track nicely. So here are some results. Here we have a adenylate kinase, and in fact, this cleft is the active region of the adenylate kinase protein. And you can see if we wanted to put the text directly inside of that cleft, that we would get a very undesirable result. So by using just a little bit of this ambient weight, we pop the text scaffold outside of the cleft and place the text directly on top of that. Here is two different nucleobases of RNA. And I'll just go through, since this is a constructive solid geometry, this is a nice sort of test case of how we can actually label something that has no surface at all, really. And we construct a surface from it, put text on, and remove the surface. Here's sort of an animation of how that ends up looking as a user rotates around. So, you know, one of the downsides of our method is that as the label rotates, of course, it eventually gets hard to read the text. But we think by labeling various different surfaces of this strand that we can, you know, at least provide multiple angles to view this. Here's another example of our aerial labeling scheme, and you'll notice that the ligand shadow tracks along this green line, which is faintly visible, and follows the annotated region quite nicely. Here's an alien. And we've annotated a bunch of different features. Notice on the jetpack that the surface itself doesn't really have a nice defined boundary, but we're still able to construct one from this algorithm. Notice on the cranium that we have a slight limitation to our method, which still needs to be resolved, that if the path itself is highly curved, the kerning of the letters may actually cause them to overlap. This is a small limitation that we intend to solve. Another result, we're labeling the ion channel of a porin protein, and these are following the channel and labeled by hand. So, like I said, we have a few limitations. Some of them are intrinsic to surface labeling. In the case of fixed labels, they may not necessarily be oriented towards the viewer, as you saw in that short movie. We also can't guarantee a uniform letter size or orientation on the screen. Unique to our approach, we do have a fair number of parameters that may not necessarily be intuitive, and they actually trade off between the various goals of, say, proximity and smoothness. So this is one of those things that requires some user attention, although we found that in general that we only really have to tune the W sub A parameter. Future work, we'd like to combine, there are three discrete steps, the scaffold generation, path formation, lettering. We'd like to combine them into one step, which more holistically addresses the challenge. In this case, it's possible that one inflexible surface may not offer the best location for a text path, so it might be a good idea to construct a sort of set of them. Text paths ignore one another at this point, so we don't do any overlap avoidance in the aerial labeling. So in conclusion, text scaffolds are amenable to legible proximal annotations of 3D models. They're very quick to compute. I haven't provided too much in the way of performance timing, but they take on the order of 5 to 10 seconds to compute and are ideally suited for large models with dense labels, we believe, because of the efficiency of the process. So our system includes methods for applying point labels, geodesic path layout, a path sketching method, and automatic labeling of annotated regions. So with that, thank you, and any questions?
So head on up to the mic if you have a question. I encourage you to think of something and go up there. Otherwise, I have to. No? Okay, so I'll ask one. This paper seems to be giving some very nice results, but it's fairly labor-intensive so far. What are your thoughts on adding some additional automation? For example, if you're given a pre-segmented and labeled data set, but where the labels aren't geometrically put onto the surface, for example.
Right. So a lot of the work that we've done in the aerial labeling specifically would be able to address that. So if you had a surface that had regions that were annotated and you constructed a text scaffold, then we could simply project those regions onto the scaffold and label it using that method, which would provide some degree of automation given annotated data. At present, we don't have a lot of sort of pipeline for importing labels in, but that's just a simple matter of coding.
Okay, good.
How would I avoid clutter? It's a very good question. I think it's a somewhat open question. The simplest thing I could say is that basically what we can do is dial the text size down and just force the user to zoom in. Since, like I said, our labels don't consider one another when they're being laid out, clutter is an issue. It's a possible issue. Yeah.
But you consider construct the distance fields, and you could do some things there, or intersection of paths that you create, or something.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, what is the largest number of labels that you placed?
Well, Just for fun, I think we placed 1,000 labeled paths on top of a, and it.
But you don't have that here.
I don't have it here. It didn't look very good. one of the things is that because of the way that we're labeling, it's not really good for static screenshots. It's one of these that we really intend a user to zoom in. In the case of the protein, for instance, this is actually our inspiration because the protein has lots of little regions. That you might want to label on the surface. Say you wanted to label all the different exposed amino acids, right? So we can just project those onto the surface, but when you get a static screenshot, it looks terrible. You really do have to zoom in.
Okay, any more questions? If not, then let's thank Greg and all the speakers one last time.